to agenda item 12, Pollinator Projects and Backyard Sanctuaries. This is a briefing. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. For the record, I'm Jeff Davis. I'm your Director of Conservation Policy. Super excited to be sitting here this morning, recognizing the sunshine outside. It's wonderful to be in this space.
A B-list space.
Maybe I'll just take a few minutes of opening remarks and then hand it to really way smarter people than myself. I want to acknowledge the director and the opportunity that he's given me to be in this new position in the agency, and some of the opportunities it's provided me to work with folks like Taylor. We have Alex behind us and Hannah Anderson. It's amazing, like when you're a habitat program director, how you're kind of focused in and maybe not as able to work across the agency. And this position really has helped me get to work with some amazing people, including new friends and partners like Woodland Park Zoo and my new friend Kirsten back there. I think that this is a really, and I'm a little biased in when I say this, this is a really important agenda item. I've heard comments about, hey, it's not, at least we're not talking about fish. And that's really true, because quite frankly, you'll talk about that later, so you'll get your fix. But part of it, from my perspective, and maybe this is too nerdy, but we don't have fish if we don't have healthy pollinators, right? If you don't have pollinators, you don't have plants. If you don't have plants, you don't have people either. So this is an area where our pollinator species are taking a beating, and yet we're going to talk about some work that the department and other partners are doing to try to get ahead and make sure that our pollinator populations are rebuilding so that we have a healthy ecosystem for fish and wildlife moving forward. I also, you've heard me say this before, but so the agency owns and manages 1 million acres. Well, the state is like 40 million acres. And so in order for us to actually achieve our preserve, protect, perpetuate, and manage mandate, that requires a lot of activation and participation from private landowners. Because we can't do it in 1 million acres or us plus the federal government on our publicly owned lands. It really takes private landowners doing sound land stewardship in order for us to be successful. I also want to recognize that when we think about salmon and orca recovery, the department spends a lot of time in those rural areas. And just maybe historically, whether it be budget driven or internal culture and philosophy, we've essentially removed ourselves outside of the regulatory tool that we have, or tools, from urban and suburban areas. And what you're going to hear from us today is an opportunity to reinvest and refocus in those urban and suburban areas, because there's a ton of opportunity there. There's been significant habitat loss, and I don't know how you can recover salmon if these urban areas aren't developed in a more environmentally sensitive way. And we have some great programs. We and our partners have some great programs to help us develop those areas in a much more environmentally sensitive way, so that the recovery burden isn't put solely on rural landowners moving forward. Maybe some more context. So we heard some public testimony about how legislatures across the country are starting to tackle this pollinator issue. And I say issue because we're like steep declines on many of our native pollinators and conversations about listings. So that should be concerning to all of us because of their importance. But our legislature also acted last session and passed a bill that created a pollinator task force that we're participating in. And they're charged with coming back to the legislature, I believe, next session with recommendations on how to maintain and recover pollinators. But also as part of that bill, we were mandated on our own department lands to prioritize pollinators in our practices. And then lastly, I think we spend a lot of time, or you spend a lot of time, on the game piece and the salmon piece and then other fisheries. And I'll say that when you see what these programs are capable of, that the agency needs to look for resources to really, and focus to really lift up the potential opportunities we have in these programs, because they're really important and there's significant opportunity and not as much investment as maybe we would like to see in accomplishing this work. So with that, I will shut up. Saw a lot of smiles with that one. And hand it over to smarter people to tell you more about these programs.
Thank you, Jeff. Chair Carpenter, Commissioners, Director Suswin, my name is Taylor Cotton. I'm the Conservation Assessment Section Manager in the Wildlife Diversity Division. And I'm happy to be here today, even if it is sunny outside, to talk about this program. This is something that I think we have an opportunity to really engage the public more on. It's important. I know we've presented a lot of pollinator topics to you before, mainly around T&E issues. And this is an opportunity that I think the public can get behind to help T&E and pollinators in general. And I'm joined here with Aaron Sullivan from the Woodland Park Zoo, who will be presenting a few slides as well. And I do want to also point out Alex Biswas in the audience sitting behind me. She is our new communications outreach education coordinator within the wildlife program, focusing on WASHPA wildlife, and particularly that urban and suburban nexus. So this presentation, I'm hoping I can go over some of the small pollinator projects we're involved in, best management practices that we use primarily through our partners and also the Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary Program, and also some opportunities that we're using and looking at to enhance particularly that Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary Program. So we talk about backyard wildlife habitat, and that starts with people. These are backyards, so I do want to address and discuss the people part of this and the social part of this. And this first bullet point is taken directly from the America's Wildlife Values Report, Washington State Report from 2018, which was funded by WAFWA and the Wildlife and Sport Fish Restoration Group. And this showed that there was an interest in continuing or increasing WASHPA wildlife opportunities from the public. Over 80% of Washingtonians felt that way, and they enjoy seeing wildlife around their homes. In addition to that data, we have stuff or information from the 2017 The Nature of Americans National Report, which was funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, Yale University, and Texas Parks and Wildlife. And that found that exposure, or most adults felt that exposure to nature promoted physical, psychological, and social well-being, but they also felt like their backyards were manufactured and not natural, and therefore not considered part of nature. And I think this Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary Program is an opportunity to show them that backyards are part of nature. They can make tangible conservation gains for things like pollinators, and not to mention bird watching and other opportunities that I'm not going to speak to as much in this presentation. But I do feel like this is a good way, or this program and pollinators in particular, is a good way of addressing some of those things that came up in those reports. So background importance of backyard wildlife habitat, particularly for pollinator conservation. As Jeff alluded to, and I know you are all aware, pollinators aren't doing great. Among bumblebees, 28% of species in North America are considered threatened, and 19% of butterflies in the U.S. and Canada are at risk of extinction, according to NatureServe. But habitat and small collections of habitat, small scale, does have an opportunity to make significant conservation gains for invertebrate species. Urban areas have demonstrated a higher bee diversity than other converted habitat. And pollinators are unique in that they're relatively small functional requirements like habitat range, life cycle, nesting behavior, relative to other wildlife, allow these small habitats and others. Oh, sorry. These small habitats to make real conservation gain. And I'll definitely give a few examples later on.
So, yeah, thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay.
You know, you say 28% of species in North America are considered threatened. Could you talk a little bit about why, how have we found ourselves? I mean, you know, as I remember 10 years ago, we didn't hear much about, you know, problems with pollinators. It seems to be an up and coming. Maybe just a little background about, why, how did we get to where we're at right now?
Absolutely. And I don't want to put Erin on the spot, but she may be able to speak to that better than I can.
Yeah. And I'm going to cover this a little bit later, but no, it's fine. There was a book that came out in the 90s called The Forgotten Pollinator, and it warned us of an impending pollination crisis. So this is something that scientists have been looking at since the 90s, if not before. It's often habitat loss is a huge part. There's more bee diversity than people realize, and what we do at the zoo is try to get people to understand that these bees are animals and that they actually need food, water, and shelter. And so oftentimes part of their life cycle might be met, but the other parts aren't. And so with habitat loss, that's definitely a hit to their life cycle, you know what I mean. It's going to impact them. Pesticide use, like not necessarily using the right tool for the right job, and a lot of pesticides that have been not thoughtfully applied. They can have a role, but there's also certain chemicals that have been more of an issue for bees than for other animals as well. So that sort of buildup of pesticides in different hives because they bring it back and feed it out. So I would say habitat loss, which means loss of food and shelter, and then pesticides are probably the main reasons.
Yeah. There is a virus as well.
There is. I don't know if you want me to keep talking. There is, but the virus is targeted more for honeybees. And so what's great about what's going on with pollinators right now is that it's completely in pop culture and everybody's talking about it and everybody wants to do something. But what I've learned in giving the lectures that I give or the public talks that I give is that when I ask people, what are you thinking of? What do you picture in your mind when I say pollinators? And 90% of the time, they're picturing a honeybee. And it's not really the honeybee that needs our attention. It does, but there's a lot of people working on that. What we really need to focus on are the native pollinators that a lot of people might not even know that they have. I mean, when I say bumblebee, a lot of people picture a big, fat bumblebee, and that's great. But there's like 13 species of bumblebees just here in Washington, and they all have different habitat needs, and they all have different nectar needs as well. So there is the virus, and that's for colony collapse disorder with honeybees, and there's a variety of things in addition to the virus. Yeah, I'll talk about this till the end of days. Bring it.
So back to urban habitat. Just a couple of studies I want to highlight. There was a project in Vancouver, BC that found 56 different species of pollinators within that urban city's habitat. There was also a project right here in Olympia that looked at pollinator sites throughout the city, including sites right here on the Capitol campus, that found 273 bumblebees and 531 individual flower visits. And that is our backyard. So transitioning a little bit to our Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary program, this is a program that really provides a backyard wildlife certification to the public. It mimics a similar program run by the National Wildlife Federation. To my knowledge, we're the only state that has their own individual Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary program separate from that. We do get calls from the public outside of Washington that are interested in our program because they've heard about it, and we have to refer them to the National Wildlife Federation version. First enrollee was in 1985, And originally it was led out of regions 1 and 4 in those urban areas of Spokane and Mill Creek, Seattle area. It was moved to headquarters in 2015 for a centralized location and is still run out of the wildlife program today. And the public is required to provide general information on habitat and information on how they're going to be managing that habitat for wildlife in particular. I did put the form in your binder to sign up for this, and you'll notice that it is fairly general. I think that's on purpose. We don't want to be excluding anybody who is interested in participating just because they may not have the means or a traditional backyard. Pollinator planters and sort of even bird feeders can make a difference on apartment complexes. But I do think that there's an opportunity there to reevaluate that, and I'll talk a little bit about that and how we're going to be going forward. So again, started in 1985. We have over 7,000 individual participants at this point. There is a $10 fee, which covers your signage that you're going to have for your yard, a certificate, and enrolling in a newsletter. The newsletter was discontinued in 2018 because it did not move into our new website and meet the new website format. We're also evaluating how we want to move forward with a new newsletter that will be suitable for our website. And the funds primarily support sign production. The funding for this program and for the administration comes directly out of our other state funding sources, including Watchable Wildlife and General Fund. And we get an average of 2 applications a week. I would emphasize that we're getting an average of 2 applications a week with very little outreach or advertising of this program. So this is all word of mouth that's coming in, and there's still that engagement. So for best management practices for habitat, oh, go ahead. Yes, I'm sorry.
Follow-up on that. I wasn't aware that we had that. I knew about the NWF one, and a lot of us commissioners have to give talks in different places, and I thought if we could get one of those, it's a good visual, because I use the NWF one, but I'd rather use ours.
We can get you a sign.
You know, when you say 2 a week, when you said that's without any advertising, I don't think...
Or very little advertising.
Well, but that's 2 a week.
Yeah.
You know, that, I don't get excited about 2, you know, but I know it could be the, you know, how much we could accommodate and all of that. But I think this is a great program, a little bit more visibility. So if we could get a sign.
Absolutely.
You know, to
that's an easy thing. I get that today.
So
talking about best management practices for pollinator habitat, we rely primarily on our partners for this. They're better at it. They're smarter than us with this sort of thing. I do want to, you know, we have the Woodland Park Zoo here with us. I do want to acknowledge the Xerxes Society, who is a nonprofit out of Portland, Oregon, and their whole emphasis is on invertebrate conservation, and they have a lot of good resources that we usually refer people to if they're looking for best management practices at small-scale habitat. We also have a landscaping
Commissioner Linville?
Sorry, we're terrible,
okay.
Aren't we?
It's all right.
So if they're invertebrate, do they delve into soil microbes? And
I don't feel they do that yet.
Okay. I can't wait till people are excited about soil.
I agree. Primarily they're focused on pollinators and aquatic mussels.
Okay, thank you.
I'd say we do have a landscaping with wildlife book that was published in 1999. It is written by one of our former urban biologists and regional program managers, Russ Link. It is a little outdated. We are still selling it. Whether we intend to update that or provide something new, I think, is a conversation we should be having because there is new information that's not provided in this book, but it is a resource that we are still providing to the public and selling. As a kind of a testament to the appetite the public has for pollinators, as Aaron mentioned, I want to highlight a project that we've been working with Xerxes Society and Woodland Park Zoo, as well as our neighboring states in Idaho and Oregon. This is the Bumblebee Atlas Project. It's funded through a competitive state wildlife grant that we earned 3 years ago. And the Atlas part of that project is a volunteer-led effort to document bumblebees across the state. The intention is to see what species we have in Washington and Idaho and Oregon, and so we get an idea of distribution. Primarily, we're also looking at western bumblebee, which has been petitioned with the Fish and Wildlife Service to be listed on the Endangered Species Act, so any information we can provide on that would be helpful, and a couple other species of greatest conservation need that we're tracking. My take-home for this is that it's been extremely popular. We've had several trainings throughout the state that have sold out in days, again, with very little beyond word of mouth publicity or advertising for that. We've had, in just 2019, we had over 2,500 volunteers submitted bumblebee observations. There's a demonstrated interest in this pollinator conservation. And an anecdote I want to highlight, going again back to that urban wildlife or urban habitat can be beneficial for pollinators. One of the observations for western bumblebee, that petitioned species, was from the Starbucks and Squim, nectaring on lavender flowers. So it doesn't require wilderness areas or anything like that to make a real gain with conservation with pollinators. And I will turn it over to Erin to speak about Woodland Park Zoo.
Good morning. Thank you all for this opportunity, and thank you, too, as well, for allowing me to be here and have a little bit of time. I already talked about a lot of this with your very thoughtful questions, but my job at the zoo, so my name is Erin Sullivan. I'm a animal care manager at the zoo, which basically means I am the interface between the keepers who take care of the animals and the animals themselves. So that's my everyday. But I'm an entomologist by training, and that really is where my heart is with invertebrate conservation. And as I mentioned, The Forgotten Pollinators was a book that came out in the 90s, and I was a beekeeper through college as well. So pollinators are really near and dear to my heart, and so I am over the moon that more people are paying attention to this now and that it is in pop culture and that's a part of the regular dialogue. And I do feel that honeybees are what really started the conversation, and I think that's fantastic. But what we really need to start paying attention to are our native bees, and because we have an amazing diversity here in Washington State for our native bees, and they do a lot of work. They are the pollinators that we all need. And when I'm talking about pollination, I think that everybody's heard that bite of we have to thank a bee for every bite of food that we eat or things like that, but it's often amorphous. I don't know if people really understand like what pollination looks like. And so whenever I'm doing a lecture, usually in a larger public, like informal basis, I bring up my lovely picture of the raspberries because it's the perfect visual for me, and it really is worth a thousand words, that the raspberry on the far left was sort of pollinated, and you get a small raspberry. The raspberry on the far right, the bumblebee got in there and did what it was supposed to do, and you ended up with a nice big raspberry. Now, who doesn't like big raspberries? I mean, that's what we all want, right? But that also is super important for wildlife, because that's not just happening with raspberries, that's happening with huckleberries, that's happening with all the fruits that are out there. And so if we lose those pollinators, we're losing that food source for native animals as well. But it's also important for the plants. Like, that's how the plants reproduce. And so if we're losing the pollinators for that, there's less seeds produced, and that means just an overall loss of plant resiliency. That's also super important. Okay, next slide, please. There we go. So there is a lot of work being done in this region for pollinators. And as we already talked, Xerxes is doing a fantastic work. The Honeybee Atlas is fantastic as well. There's also smaller projects that are going on. University of Washington has a few projects. WSU is super involved as well. And then there's more renegade projects. So there's the Pollinator Pathway in Seattle, which an artist decided to take a mile-long stretch of Seattle and turn people's parking strips into pollinator gardens in the hopes of giving the animals more habitat, giving them more space. There's also the Common Acres in Seattle that's doing a lot of fantastic work. And at Woodland Park Zoo, we were doing what we could do as well. We have a longstanding butterfly conservation program with the Oregon Silver Spot Butterfly. We're also, you know, helpful with Taylor's Checker Spot, and we're also starting to be more involved with Island Marble. So we're doing our part for butterflies. We also have Bug Club at the zoo, which has been running for 23 years, and that's hopefully starting the next generation of bug enthusiasts. And, you know, people always talk about bugs and kids, but there's a reason. It's bugs are the first animals that kids see in their backyard. You know, they're out there, they're seeing them. It's a nature safari every day for them. And bugs are everywhere, and kids are everywhere. And if we can connect those two things, we can really make a difference, right? So our bug club's been super active. We also have a backyard habitat at the zoo to focus on the pollinators as well as other backyard habitat aspects. We have a huge butterfly exhibit where we talk about pollinators in there as well. And then when you leave our pollinator, when you leave the butterfly exhibit, you enter into a pollinator garden that has seven different ways that people can take what they've learned at our zoo home and create a pollinator habitat at home. So all these little things were going on, and we realized at the zoo that part of the things that we can do is also bring people together. So in 2018, we hosted a pollinator summit to get everybody that was doing some work with pollinators in the same room so we could do some gap analysis and figure out where we weren't doing some work, and then figuring out what we were doing too much of and figuring out who best to do what work. We're hoping to do that again in 2020, and there were a few things that percolated out of that as well. But we can always do more. And so this is what we'd really like to do at the zoo as far as working with pollinators is to, as I mentioned earlier, get people to understand that they're animals. They need to know what they're actually talking about and what they're trying to save. If they know what's in their backyard, which is why the Bumblebee Atlas is such a great idea, they know what's there, they can identify it, and they can actually tailor their backyard to meet the needs of the animals that are there and not just give them a bunch of food, but no shelter. We can also really work with people to help them change their backyards from basically a landscape of grass, which is not helpful to pollinators, into more of a pollinator-rich environment that can actually make a difference. A small piece of land that's transformed can really make a difference. We can also work with them to understand their pesticide use and the impacts that it might have and give them the right tools for the right jobs. And then the last thing that I think we'd love to do more of at the zoo is find more people to collaborate and partner with. Because as I mentioned with that gap analysis, there's a lot of people doing really good work, but our strength is where we work together, because it is going to take a lot of people solving a lot of different problems in order to be able to make a difference for pollinators. Back to you.
Thank you. So speaking back to our backyard sanctuary program, some areas that I know Alex is trying to spearhead with how we want to work with this in the future. Re-engage with the backyard sanctuary enrollees. That's an R that we talk about maybe with our traditional constituents, but we don't talk about with this sort of audience very often, but I do think it's relevant. And that's the other one, is getting us relevant with the public who aren't hunting and angling. I think this is a key opportunity. And we are collecting all that information or all their contact information when they're enrolling, but we've never followed up on them. You know, are they maintaining this habitat after they've originally signed up? Are they interested in doing more? They've obviously reached out to us initially because they're interested in conservation or watching wildlife in their backyard. So there may be opportunities for more there. We're also exploring a tiered backyard certification program and updating the sign-up process. As you'll see on that form, it is very general, and we want to keep it inclusive so that everybody can participate if they want to participate. But we also want to encourage, if we can, doing more than just checking a box. You know, checking a box is great if that's all you can do, but we also get some people that sign up and send us entire, you know, photo dictionaries of what they're doing in their backyard, and we want to help encourage that and reward them for that good work. And engaging neighborhoods and HOAs to help jointly build habitat and create incentives around maintaining habitat. Go ahead. Yes.
So I am very interested in reconnecting people with food. And I was curious if there's any in neighborhoods that allow it, if there's any possibility for between veggie gardens and pollinator habitat. I mean, I know not all vegetables require pollinators, but some do. And is there, is there any talk about that?
There was a project that was being run in Seattle through the pea patch there, which is more, fruit, veggie focused, because tomatoes and bees are just, bumblebees are like that.
Yeah.
We haven't talked a lot about adding more pollinator, like nectar plants, to those areas. So that's definitely a place that could be more improved. We've started to talk to one of the areas where I'd like to do a little bit more work is with landscape architects, because they are getting these bigger projects in Seattle and they get a piece of land and they have to do something, but they don't necessarily always promote plant for pollinators. And when we were talking to some landscape architecture friend, that's when the soil came up, because they said so often the plantings that they plant end up failing because they don't have an understanding of the soils. So I did forget to mention that we're working on a pollinator toolkit for Earth Day 2020 that is going to have some soil how to take care of your soil in order to take care of the plants that then can be taking care of the bees. But as far as I know, are not doing anything right now with veggies.
I would really encourage some thought into that. It's such a beautiful connection between growing food and then the connection with your food coming from pollinators and soil. I mean, it just seems to me like an obvious
connection.
Full circle thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'll add to the potential initiatives. I'm going to use the words Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which would be a meaningful amount of federal money coming to the department to help our partners and our programs really put these opportunities on steroids. And that, as an example, could fund landscape architects across the state to be of service to landowners trying to develop these types of habitats on there. The community gardens is another one that could really benefit from an infusion of resources. And another partner that's not necessarily here with us today, a couple partners, Audubon, and a big one in especially growing in urban areas is the conservation districts. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll probably see some words in our strategic plan that says, how do we identify all the partners and sit down like Woodland Park Zoo has done and figure out where are the gaps and where are the priority areas and how can we really lift up all of these programs, because it's going to take that scope and scale to really make a huge difference for fish and wildlife.
Okay, so I agree with that, but not really. And so I would like to, we do need to do a lot of big work and put words on our strategic plan and all of that. But what I'd like to see, if it's possible, RAWA or not, is getting back to our homeowners. And so what I'm looking for is something that has happened a couple of times in my life, in my lifespan. I spent maybe a year and a half, miserable year and a half in Las Vegas in the late 70s. And at that time, I was a bartender. What did but at that time, everybody had yards. The water crisis hadn't hit. Now, and everybody had nice yards and fertilized and all of that, cut. If you go to Las Vegas now or anywhere in Arizona, there aren't yards. There are rock gardens and there are cactus. And in fact, people who have yards are kind of like they're judged. What I would like to see is changing our yards into these kind of sanctuaries and have that sign be a sign of pride. Maybe have a youth program. So that's going to happen on the ground. You guys at the level you are, you'll deal with landscape architects and all that, although I will note that the big buildings in Las Vegas have followed suit with that arid landscaping. So to the extent that we can give the public, who is getting increasingly freaked out, I'm sure, about things like hearing that pollinators are on the endangered species list, oh my God. And that we don't need huge habitats and to try to get fish back in the Columbia or whatever, these big projects. Each person can do it. I'd like to have us work on doing that. I realize this is a cheerleader thing, but what I was trying to say is that the shift in gestalt starts in people's backyards and parking strips, and I'd love to see us focus some time and energy on that.
Let's try to pollinate.
Commissioner Thorburn, please.
Thank you. Thanks. Great presentation. So one of the things that I've been thinking about as we had a little discussion this morning and looking at the presentation all in advance, sort of department role, because that's what we're looking at. And then it kind of tripped me when you were talking about working with landscape architects. And one of the things that we do well, naturally, or we do. I'm not sure the public thinks that we always do it well. We monitor populations. And that's a great thing for citizen community science. And so as we embark on projects, you know, we want to know that we're being effective and accomplishing what we want, which is, you know, providing the habitat for these critters. And so engaging in pre-planning of the project and then setting it up so that it can be monitored, maybe with a citizen science activity, I think is something where we could jump in and engage.
Totally agree that this is a massive, and we all talk about that community science piece, right? And so that is more of kind of our future focus is how do we help remove barriers for people wanting to landscape in a way that changes our public perception of needing a lawn and watering it and spraying it and all sorts of things. So we actually aren't disagreeing about how to approach this. And then there's the, you know, maybe the landowners match could be we train them in basic protocols and what to look for and what times a year to look for that. And then we also know that our data infrastructure as part of our strategic plan that we'll roll out says internally we need to have a different data infrastructure so that we across the enterprise can see our own data. But also there's a community science portal that has to be constructed in that too so that the data can come in and we can all be seeing how we're doing collectively. So appreciate those comments.
I just want to mention a couple other points. I think, Commissioner Baker, you made a good discussion topic there. And I think the other piece of the Backyard Sanctuary program, you know, regardless of whether it's birds or pollinators or anything like that, is making the public aware of what we do, engaging them so that they're associating that habitat in their backyard as nature, going back to those first couple of slides, and then also associating us as an agency with that nature as too. We do plan to hopefully promote this more than we have in the past to get more than this, the 2 a week, and absolutely get the signs out there so people can see them. And continue to work closely with our partners at the zoo and Xerxes Society to energize this as much as we can. And that is my final slide. So,
Maybe a very strange question. Have you engaged or is there an industry group with the farm and garden, with the landscaping community, not the landscaping community, you know, like you go to a farm and garden store to buy things. Is there any kind of cross-promoting that could be done with this concept? I mean, it just seems like a natural. I live in the Skagit Valley, and I can think of a couple places that would be just very opportunistic to put some information on display and maybe have a couple sample raised beds or something.
Absolutely, and I think Aaron could probably speak to some of this as well. We're putting new emphasis on this program in the last year and trying to highlight some of those low-hanging fruit for us to engage with. We've already reached out a little bit to the Master Gardeners as an opportunity for that, but we're just scratching the surface, and that's nice, soothing music.
Thank you very much.
That's what pollinators can do.
That was some bee music.
Yeah, we're just scratching the surface.
Look forward to hearing more.
Take his last time.
Graybill, you go to the penalty box for 5 minutes.
It's a good thing it's a bee thing and not a
But there are so many things like that that we can do, that's why we were trying to get everybody in the same room so that we were doing it a little bit more strategically, so that we didn't have somebody talking to one organization talking to this garden store and another one talking to this one. So it really is a matter of trying to get all of those, identifying who the partners are and getting them together in a room so that we can move forward thoughtfully with this, because there's so much great stuff that we can do.
Yeah. I would expect that, and I don't know this for a fact, but I would expect that industry has an industry group. I would expect it would be that maybe there's a way to make some linkage to somebody in leadership there, but from my perspective, I think this has been really informative. Something I was interested in but knew very little about, so I hope we can do a follow-up to this sometime in the future.
And he's a gardener, so he's got a vested interest.
Yeah. Grow more tomatoes.
Yeah. So, anything else from any of the other? Major? Folks, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Jeff,
thank
go
you.
Ahead. Have a good weekend.